Thank you very much, Aaron. Thank you very much for coming. Actually, I feel very honoured to be invited, not only once, but twice. I also found over the years that it's a good idea to flatter your host, especially if you're 300 miles from home and you haven't got a car. I think the idea for this conference, therefore, towards a modern metaphysic is spot on. And in this context, I'm not going to talk about Ibn Arabi because I don't know much about him, but I would like to quote Sayyid Hossein Nasser, who I'm sure most of you know from the University of Washington. And he said, "The disappearance of metaphysics, or metaphysic," he said, "is most directly responsible for the modern predicament." And I'm sure that's right, actually. I think that sort of summarizes it. And my own background is in science. I mean, I'm educated in... People like to say, "I am trained in science." I don't like to say that. I like to say sea lions are trained. Human beings should be educated. And I like to think I'm educated in science. The first thing to establish, of course, is what metaphysics actually is. And let me quote Sayyid Nasser again. And he says, "Metaphysics, which in fact is one and should be named metaphysic in the singular, is the science of the real, of the origin and the end of things, of the absolute and, in its light, the relative. It can be obtained only through intellectual intuition and not simply through ratiocination. It thus differs from philosophy as it is usually understood." Jolly good. He goes on to say, which is slightly surprising, but there we are, I'm going to quote him anyway, "It's a theoria of reality whose realization means sanctity and spiritual perfection, and therefore can be achieved only within the cadre of a revealed tradition, which gives efficacy to certain symbols and rites upon which metaphysics must rely for its realization." I find that quite convenient because I like to use the word religion, and a religion, if he's not defining a religion there, I don't know what is. He's talking about a moral framework within which you can contain, as it were, metaphysical views of the world and metaphysical ways of thinking. To me, the essence of metaphysics is the idea of transcendence. And it's very... we'll talk about transcendence later, I trust. But in a nutshell, as far as I can see, transcendence is the idea that there is more in the universe than meets the eye. Very crude. Or that there is more in the universe than you can stub your toe on. And the things that are in the universe that don't meet the eye and you can't stub your toe in things like consciousness, and they include things like meaning, and they include things like purpose. And if you have a sense that the universe is not totally indifferent, for example, in the way that Richard Dawkins says, and that it does have some purpose to it, and it is in all those things, then I think this is very definitely in the realms of metaphysics. And what metaphysics therefore is, as far as I can see, is an attempt to get to grips with transcendence, to increase awareness of it, to cultivate responsiveness to it, and as it were, to understand it. This kind of thinking, this sort of dwelling on the idea of transcendence, is the very antithesis of the kinds of ideas that now dominate the modern world, and, that now prevail in the modern world. And the ideas that now prevail in the modern world, well, are those basically of the West and the Western military and so on, the Western commerce. And they are, as one might say, as near as damn it, entirely materialistic. And they're materialistic at all levels. I mean, they're materialistic in the literal sense that Lucretius had when Lucretius said, paraphrasing, "The universe consists of nothing except atoms and the void." And the whole kind of modern scientific paradigm, you could say. There are plenty of very religious scientists, but the whole sort of science qua science is built on that supposition that there is nothing but atoms and the void, as it were, with the laws of physics, making sure that they all behave themselves. And this way of thinking, i.e. that there are the laws of physics applied to atoms and the void, is what is now meant, really, when you boil it down, by rationalism. And rationalism itself is really about logic, and it's about math, and it's about not going wrong when you're thinking ideas. But it's become entirely, or very, very closely linked in the minds of, as it were, the ruling elite with the idea of this very stripped-down notion of the universe as being nothing but atoms in the void. And what really we need, it seems to me, is a new worldview. And it's a worldview that will incorporate the idea of transcendence, which is the idea that's gone missing. And really, transcendence, or the idea of transcendence, which very, very loosely I'm going to say is the notion of religion, has to be right at the centre of the worldview. And it's been eliminated, more or less. You just don't find it in the thinking of Gordon Brown or in the thinking even of Obama, and he was a lot better than George Bush, and so on and so on and so on and so on. So how we go? So first question, NASA talks about the world being in a predicament. I'm not going to dwell on this because we, in a way we all know it, but let's just run over very, very quickly the predicament that the world is in. It's actually in a really horrible mess, and there are nice little statistics, well, they're horrible statistics, but there are statistics which summarise it, like of the 7 billion people now in the world, nearly 7, about a billion are permanently undernourished. Of all the species in the world, probably half are in imminent danger of extinction. We all know about the elimination of forests, the pollution of rivers, the spoliation of oceans, and in addition to that, of course, we have global warming. So you have very, very sober people these days, like the former president of the Royal Society, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, warning us that we're possibly quite unlikely to get through the 21st century in a tolerable state. I mean, Rowan Williams was saying the other day, possibly 2 billion people could die by the end of the century from global warming alone. I think that's actually quite a conservative estimate. I think we're right on the brink. And what you see with the modern governments is that they're in denial. I mean, they're just carrying on doing the same as usual. They haven't even begun to recognise the problems, even at a material level, and they certainly haven't begun to acknowledge that there's any kind of transcendent dimension that ought to be taken into account. Underneath all these policies that are leading to all these disasters are a series of ideas which are just horribly wrong. And they're horribly wrong morally. I mean, I just don't think there's anything that seriously passes as moral philosophy in among powerful governments. Morality these days, defined more or less by Margaret Thatcher, is what emerges from the marketplace. If you're prepared to pay for it, it's okay. The only taboo I could think of that's left, actually, is child molesting. I mean, however much you pay for that is still considered to be wrong. But virtually everything else is, if you pay for it, if you can pay for it, it's okay. I've even heard human cloning. I mean, in a serious conference, I've heard human cloning and genetic engineering defended on the grounds that it was potentially a billion-dollar business. Great. But it's okay if it's a billion-dollar business. I mean, the morality is gone. And it isn't just that it's utilitarian to the nth degree where it's actually measured purely in terms of cash. I mean, it's gross to me. Obviously it's gross. So it's morally wrong, the present worldview. It's also very obviously factually wrong because it misconstrues what the universe is really like. It misconstrues what human beings are really like. If it misses out the concept of transcendence, and if transcendence is in fact an important part of the universe, then to miss it out as a matter of policy is to give a totally false idea of what the universe as a whole is really like. And I think there is a very, very pessimistic view of human beings that underpins modern economics. You know, that human beings are basically acquisitive, that human beings are made happy by acquisition, that we actually all want to be on top, that it's, you know, we're driven by our ambition to be on top. All these things are a complete misconception of what human beings are like. And they all, in a way, they spring, well, they're ancient, actually. I mean, the idea of original sin is in there, and that's a very ancient idea. The Enlightenment idea that human beings are basically savage and need to be kicked into place by authority figures, that's much later, but it's the same idea coming from a different direction. And I've heard politicians say this kind of thing quite recently. It's this very, very, very pessimistic view of what human beings are like, and that's underpinned by this very crude form of modern Darwinism, so-called neo-Darwinism. It's actually neo-neo-Darwinism. It's actually what Richard Dawkins calls ultra-Darwinism. And that's basically the idea that we would all be at each other's throats were it not for the fact that we'd probably come unstuck if we did. I mean, it is a grossly pessimistic view of what human beings are like and what creatures alike. And this, nonetheless, is part of our great prevailing worldview. And then in addition to being morally flawed, in addition to being factually wrong, the present overwhelming prevailing worldview is incoherent. The different bits of it simply don't hang together. And one of the ways in which they really don't hang together is that there are, in the modern world, some very serious moralists who do say very good things. I mean, the Dalai Lama says wonderful things about how human beings should behave. And so does Archbishop Tutu. I've heard some wonderful sermons from him. And Rowan Williams is you know, very, very fine moralist. And there are many more from all walks, really. And yet none of this seems to me, but apart from Tutu, who's had a sort of brief political rise in the wake of apartheid, none of this has any effect on the way governments conduct themselves. And if Rowan Williams points out that there is something morally wrong with, for example, the invasion of Iraq, he is told to shut up. You know, it's up to New Labour to decide what is right in this world. It's not up to mere archbishops. I mean, we've got this incoherent worldview, which on the one hand kind of respects and people like Williams, gives Nobel Prizes, I think, to the Dalai Lama, certainly to Archbishop Tutu, but then completely ignores what they say, takes no notice whatever of what they say. Grotesque, grotesque. Furthermore, I think possibly even the worst of all, we have lost the means by which we could get ourselves out of this mess. As it were, the powers that be, if you started talking to them about transcendence and all that kind of stuff, they would simply, they glaze over. I mean, I've almost tried it. It's not worth it. They don't know what you're talking about, and they don't want to know. It's not on their radar, as they say in the modern cliche. They can't think about it. So they've got it wrong, and yet they can't even think in the right ways that would get them out of it. And since they have such tremendous power, that means they can't even think in the right ways that would get us out of it, the whole world out of it. Underlying all this, excuse me, in this post-Western Renaissance age, post-Enlightenment age, is this idea of rationality. Everything that happens in the modern world among all these people is justified by the notion of rationality. People like, I'll go back to Dawkins, people like Dawkins and Dennett and all those other people, these sort of modern scientist atheists or scientist philosophers atheists, are always, and A.C. Grayling's one of the worst offenders here, always holding up rationality as the thing you have to stick to, and the only thing that should be taken seriously. What they don't realise, actually, there's two things they don't realise, big things. One is that rationality very definitely has its limits, and this is something, you know, I'll be talking about in a minute. It isn't the be-all and end-all. It isn't the answer to all our problems. The other thing is, though, that they love to say that anyone who is any kind of theologian, anyone who is in any kind of religious person, is behaving non-rationally, by definition, as far as they're concerned, and they conflate the word non-rational with the word irrational. Well, the word non-rational means that you're choosing not to adopt a particular way of thinking that the rationalists happen to approve of. Irrational, of course, means mad. So by saying irrational when they mean non-rational, they simply say that all theologians are mad. They also have it in their heads that, as it were, well, they love to quote medieval theologians. I can't believe that any of them have ever read any. But they love to suggest that medieval theologians are, as it were, perversely non-rational or irrational. And people like Lewis Wolpert, I don't know if you know Lewis Wolpert, he used to be quite famous, I think he's mercifully getting less famous, but he likes to make these sort of standard jokes, like the point about religious people is they like to believe six impossible things before breakfast. I mean, that kind of nonsense is what one hears, for example, on the radio. The simple truth is, anyone who knows anything about medieval theology can see that from the beginning, basically from St. Thomas, but even before that, but certainly from St. Paul and Augustine and then Anselm and so on, these guys were obsessed with reason. I mean, the whole of medieval theology is, well, basically from Anselm onwards, as an attempt to reconcile Christian theology with Aristotle and to then with Plato. It's an attempt to put the two things together. And almost some of the absurdities, one has to say, that they may be perceived to have got into were due to this attempt to rationalise their way, for example, to a proof of God and all that kind of stuff. But they were obsessed with reason and always have been. And this is part of the great thread of theology right from the beginning. I think in Islam, as well as in Christianity, is the attempt to reconcile one's ability to think rationally with one's, as it were, grasp, prehension of transcendence. And what now passes as rationality, however, this is a sort of coup de grace, what now passes as rationality is just horribly crude. It's just a kind of form of arithmetic, really. And I dare say there are accountants in this room, and I don't want to insult accountants because I like accountants and some of my best friends are accountants and all that thing. But as I think Churchill said about scientists, they should be on tap but not on top. And if you start assessing, well, the world in terms of accountancy, just simple arithmetic, you are in deep trouble. And I've been interested in conservation for many, many years, forever really. And a few years ago, as it were, conservationists were told they shouldn't just talk about the intrinsic worth of wild creatures and all that kind of stuff. They should talk about the value of agrotourism. That was a great saviour. And this obviously, except in a very few places, was never going to raise enough money. So now the emphasis has shifted. Well, basically it was agrotourism unless you've discovered oil, in which case, forget that. That's good. But nowadays, that is sort of the emphasis has shifted. People are beginning to talk about the value of biodiversity and natural services and all that. So nowadays, if you want to preserve a forest, you have to show that forests make a better job of clearing up sewage than civil engineering does. Cheaper. And if you can do that, you can have your forest. If you haven't got that, forget it. No. And that is what now passes as rationality. And if you said, no, the forest has an intrinsic worth and all those things, that's not rational, therefore it's bad, therefore it wouldn't happen. On the broader front, science is perceived as the sort of quintessence of rationality, the exemplar of rationality. Everything that is done in the name of science is held to be, as it were, good or okay or respectable because it's supposed to be rational. There are so many mistakes about that. Wait a minute, let me just... Yes, I'm losing my thread here. I've been going so well and now I've lost my thread. One of the key issues here is just the limits of rationality. And the guy who summarised, I think, an aspect of this very, very well was the arch-rationalist David Hume, who in the 18th century was talking about morality in the context of being a rational person. And he simply pointed out that you could not, in fact, think your way to a moral position. He never actually said you cannot derive an ought from an is. But that is the summary of what he says. Just because the universe is the way it is doesn't mean to say that is the way you should behave. And neither can you produce a perfectly logical, rational argument that will take you from an observation of how the world is to a suggestion about how you ought to behave. And he said, if you want to arrive at a moral position, in the end it's about emotional response. In the end it's about feelings. And this is from the guy who sits right at the centre of the Enlightenment. And what that to me suggests is that you simply can't have a moral position unless you go out of your way to, as it were, cultivate your emotional responses. This actually is what's meant by virtue ethics, and it's quite interesting that virtue ethics is now, as it were, coming back into fashion. As I see it then, the modern sort of conflict is between what one might call metaphysics on the one hand and this sort of modern strange form of rationality on the other. And it's sort of condensed into the conflict, the very noisy conflict, the spat between science and religion. And we've been presented with them both by people like Dawkins and Dennett and Atkins and Hibbert and all the rest of them, Wolpert and so on the one hand, as a sort of defenders of science and all that. And on the other hand, the sort of Southern Baptists, all scientists are bad and, you know, Darwinians should be hanged, that kind of thing. It's been presented as that. This is so gross and so bad, and yet it sort of dominates the airways. The interesting thing is that both sides get science and religion wrong. Neither side really knows what either of them actually is. And it's quite... you'd expect, in a way, the Southern Baptists to get science wrong because they're not really scientists. But I think Dawkins and Dennett get it wrong, and they're the great defenders of science. And you would expect Dawkins and Dennett to get it religion wrong because they've never actually read any or taken it seriously. But you wouldn't actually expect the Southern Baptists to get it wrong because that's what they do, and yet they do get it wrong. Here is a statement from... And it's peculiar that you have this very, very noisy conflict between two sides, science and religion, when neither side knows what the subject is that they're actually trying to contrast. Here is a statement from Peter Atkins, who is a professor of organic chemistry at Oxford, very, very highly rated as an organic chemist, absolutely sort of ardent atheist, even more so than Dawkins, actually. But here is a statement, a quote from one of his books, which I think is absolutely grotesque. "Science, the system of belief founded securely on publicly shared, reproducible knowledge, emerged from religion." I think that's probably true. "As science..." but then it becomes really grotesque. "As science discarded its chrysalis to become its present butterfly, it took over the heath." Well, there's a metaphor. "There is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Only the religious, among whom I include not only the prejudiced, but also the underinformed, hope there is a dark corner to the universe, or of the universe of experience, that science can never hope to illuminate. But science has never encountered a barrier," good knee, "and the only grounds for supposing that reductionism will fail are pessimism on the part of scientists and fear in the minds of the religious." I think you should applaud at this point. So there. It is very obvious nonsense, so one shouldn't really waste time on it, but I just want to... There's a few things. He says, "Suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of religion." What does "deal with" actually mean? What does he mean by "deal with"? I think, you see, we should be interested in truth. It seems to me quite a nice thing to be interested in. And it seems to me that the people who really got truth right, is it, in a way, are the lawyers who insist when you... I've never been in a court of law, actually, but I've seen it on the telly. And they insist when you go in to a court of law that you should tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's jolly good. It is, of course, an absolutely impossible aspiration. It's an ideal. You can't possibly tell the whole truth because you can't possibly know what the whole truth is. You cannot possibly tell nothing but the truth because the way your brain works, you're going to be filling in the gaps and all that kind of stuff. It's an but it's a nice ideal. Does science really tell us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Well, it might try to, but as every philosopher of science worth his salt the last 150 years has been telling us, it cannot possibly do that. And one of the great philosophers of science of the 20th century was Karl Popper, who simply pointed out that it's actually impossible to prove any idea in science in the way that you prove a mathematical formula. You can't demonstrate an empirical fact about the universe beyond all possible doubt. And J.S. Mill really gave the reason for that 100 years before Popper, when he said you just can't know what you've missed out. You can't know, there might be alternative explanations, there might be facts you haven't taken account of. And of course there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of that in the history of science, where people think they've got the truth, the whole truth, and then something else happens and they realise that they got it completely wrong, or almost completely wrong. I think the obvious example is Newton, yes, being superseded by Einstein, but there are many, many others. The other thing is that the view of science, the view of the universe that science gives, is always going to be partial. It's always going to be dealing with an aspect. And Tina was talking yesterday about, you know, the great metaphor of the elephant, where you grab hold of the leg and you say it's like a tree, and you grab hold of the snake and tail, I mean, whatever it is, you grab hold of something else and you say it's like something else. that kind of thing. And science, actually, funny enough, is like this, really. You focus on things, and then you join the dots, and you always get a partial view. And when even when you get some beautiful, beautiful statement, like E equals MC squared, it's obviously an abstraction. It's dealing with one little relationship between one little thing and another thing. He's not saying Einstein was much too bright to suppose that he was summarizing what the whole universe is like. He's picking out one little aspect. And it's got, and all science is bound to be partial, so it's always bound to be uncertain. It's always bound to be partial. Then there is this wonderful principle of Occam's razor, which I'm sure you know, William of Occam, 14th century friar. Probably Occam in Surrey. Could be Occam in Yorkshire, who knows, but probably Surrey. Anyway, William of Occam. And he said, basically, if you're trying to explain things, you shouldn't drag in things that you don't need to drag in. And he was actually having a go at Aristotle, or was having a go at Aquinas, who was a great fan of Aristotle, and saying you don't need the idea of essences. You need God, and you've got reality, but you don't need this idea of essences, so chuck it out. And this has become known as the principle of Occam's razor, although Occam never used that expression. And modern scientists have picked up on it and said that all statements about the universe should be as simple as possible, basically. Certainly they should never be gratuitous. If you should never be dragging in, you don't need things to drag in. Now, as a principle for keeping your head straight, that's quite good. As a way of, as a royal road to the truth, as Occam himself would have perfectly well known, it is no kind of guide at all, because, you know, actually the universe might be very complicated. There is no assumption at all that the simplest explanation is the best. So, but scientists wield Occam's razor, as it were, like a machete, and apply it to everything and go for the greatest possible simplicity, and assume, therefore, they must be getting to the truth. And not necessarily at all. Actually, when I say scientists, I'm being very cavalier, because I know many, many scientists who are very, very subtle, and they don't think this at all. But that isn't the view that gets, this isn't the one that prevails, the one that comes to the top. The scientist, though, for me, or the philosopher of science that really summarizes what science is about, is Peter Medawar, great mid-20th century zoologist. And he had coined this wonderful expression, science is the art of the soluble. And he got that from Bismarck, who said politics is the art of the possible. And Aaron very wittily took the art of the soluble and made it the art of the insoluble and made it the title of my talk, which I thought was rather clever. Thank you. So there we are. I'm flattering my host again. Not at all moved. But there, there we are. But the point about saying science is the art of the soluble, what he means is that if you want to be a halfway respectable or successful science, you have to ask only those questions that you think you are capable of answering with the tools available in the time available. In other words, it's a very, very pragmatic thing, very sensible. But what it means is that the whole of science actually is a circularity, it's a tautology. And the reason that scientists can give such a wonderfully neat and concise answers is that they are very, very careful to tailor the questions before they ask them. Very good, really. You ask yourself a question you know you can answer, and then you answer it, and say, there you are, got it. Brilliant, that, isn't it? Now, does this lead us to omniscience? Does this lead us to justify, all the stuff that Atkins was saying? No, of course it doesn't. Go back to J.S. Mill. You cannot logically possibly, you cannot know what it is you don't know. You cannot get the scope of what you don't know. Is there, to quote Atkins itself, are there no dark corners of the universe that science cannot penetrate? Well, actually, there seem to be quite a few. I mean, one is, I think, the issue of consciousness. It's a strange thing. It's real. But what does science say about it? Where is science dealing with this? And then there are questions that are always just about out of reach. I mean, okay, you've got your laws of physics, and they seem to explain, you know, if you wave your arms a bit, how the world sort of does what it does. But if you ask a question like, how come the laws of physics are that way, it becomes a bit hard. And they come up with, some scientists come up with sort of ad hoc responses, like, you know, the reason the laws of the universe fit so well together is that in the beginning, as 'twere, whatever that was, there was an infinity of universes, and natural selection selected the one in which they all worked. Well, they like that because they know about natural selections. But, you know, it's completely ad hoc invention, which breaks all the rules, Occam and everybody else, and yet there we are. That's considered to be sort of respectable. In practice, excuse me, scientists deal with very, very difficult questions in various ways. The questions of that kind. Some of them actually just give up. They say, we don't know the answer, and there really is no point in trying. And I think that's actually quite sensible. It's quite defeatist, but it's quite sensible. And I've had conversations with, and I used to do stuff for the radio, and I've had nice conversations with physicists, although I'm not a physicist. And I remember asking some chap once, how do you envisage a universe with 9 dimensions or 11 dimensions? Because he was sort of describing the 9, etc. And he said, I don't, I just do the math. This is quite good. And I actually asked another scientist the other day, in Oxford, some senior bloke, you know, and the same sort of question, how do you know, deal with what the Big Bang was really like and all that? And he said, I'm much too busy doing my own stuff. I can't possibly think about it. So many of them just don't think about the big stuff, and that is simply the case. Others, like Atkins, like Dennett, are... Not that Dennett is a scientist, but he's a philosopher of science, are actually logical positivists. And logical positivists, as I understand them... I'm not a philosopher, really, but there are people in the room who are. But logical positivists, as I understand them, said, if you cannot give a definite answer to a question, then the question is meaningless. Now, that's jolly good, isn't it? Or if you cannot theoretically give a definite answer. In those days, we're talking about the time of the First World War, Popper hadn't yet been around, and Gödel hadn't yet been around, who pointed out the intrinsic uncertainty of maths. And so they really did think, these chaps, that you could, in... prove things in science beyond any doubt, and they really did think that maths was the way to do it, that maths was absolutely unquestionable and unequivocal in its results. Later, both these things turned out to be true. But what they said was, if you cannot give a definite answer, as it were, mathematically, scientifically, then it is a stupid question, so don't ask it. Only an idiot would ask this question. And basically, again, this is what Dennett says in great length when he's sort of refuting the whole idea of religion. You know, the questions are not answerable definitely, so they're stupid questions, so any idiot would answer them, so I'm not going to waste my time on it. I think it takes 400 pages or so to say that. But that basically is it. And it's this kind of dogmatic approach where, again, you're saying, if I can't answer it with my techniques, then it's a non-question. Well, that doesn't seem very good. Another group of scientists are, in fact, pretty deeply religious people, even if they don't espouse religion. It's quite a common thing among scientists. Quite interesting and strange that they can be very religious people and talk about that and yet reject formal religions. And I think the sort of the archetype in a way of this was Einstein, who often said, I am a very religious man, and often talked about God and was vehemently anti-Jewish, although he was in fact a Jew and didn't want any other religion either. Darwin, I think, was clearly a very religious man who fell foul of the Christian theology of his century, which indeed a hell of a lot of people did. And one of the most interesting cases, I think, in recent years is Sakharov, the great dissident Russian physicist, who said, of course I don't believe in God or spirituality, any of this stuff. This is a complete nonsense. Nevertheless, it's obvious to me that there is an intelligence behind the universe, which is... Thank you very much. It's also very interestingly the case, I think, that scientists, I said, get science wrong. It is simply not as rational as they like to think it is. It's full of assumptions that can't be tested. It's all about testable hypotheses, but it's full of assumptions that can't be tested. It's full of kind of little logical jumps that you have to make because you can't always move inexorably from one idea to the next. And what it actually is, in the end, like every other piece of human understanding, is a narrative. In fact, it's a story that we tell ourselves. It's a very fine story. It's very good. I like it. I spend my time writing about it. But it's still a story. And what we call truth in science actually is a story that we happen at the time to find convincing. And that's basically it. And next year it might be something else we find convincing. But this idea that with science you've got this sort of inexorable edifice of truth that you build stone by stone, which is what most of us, I think, are still taught at school insofar as we're taught these things, and what people like Lewis Wolpert actually state, is absolute nonsense. It's much more like a landscape painting that you just add to and add to and add to, and then when it gets too messy, you throw it away and start all over again. That's what it's like. And so anyway, one gets this very peculiar position where the scientists who are arguing the case for science against religion simply don't know really what science is. And what science actually does when you're trying to discuss questions like how come the universe is like this, etc., etc., what it really does is to demonstrate the limits of rationality insofar as it is itself rational. What about religion? Well, I take a sort of very liberal view of religion. I'm not a Christian, I'm not a Muslim, I'm not anything really, but I take religion very seriously. And as I see it, and people disagree with this, I know, but I see it as a humanity's collective attempt to make sense of everything. In other words, to provide a narrative that really is as complete as possible, which takes account of transcendence, etc., etc., etc. Now, my wife, who's much more advanced in this kind of thinking than I am, says, no, it's a search for God. And I don't think those two ways of looking at it are incompatible, actually. I think the search for a complete narrative about how the world is and the search for God are really like two sides of the world of the same coin. And what we're really looking for is, I think, is a coherent worldview, one in which all the different bits, what ought we to do, what the universe is really like, etc., all fit together, all follow from the same narrative. And one wants the narrative to be true, one wants it to say how the world, what the world is really like, as well as, and not just this sort of abstraction. It follows, therefore, that a religion properly defined must contain a cosmology. It must, like science, contain an attempt to show how the world really is. It must have a moral code, moral ideas embedded within it, because it is actually trying to tell us how to behave within this universe. And the cosmology of, if given that religions do, as a general rule, contain a cosmology, they all have an idea of how the world is, religion ought to welcome science, because actually science is rather good at cosmology. I mean, it's got its limitations, but it's actually rather good at telling us what the universe is really like, and has a formal way of going about it. And the antagonism, therefore, between science and religion becomes absurd. And so does the idea that, for example, was espoused by Stephen Jay Gould. He had this very sort of highfalutin expression that science and religion are non-overlapping magisteria. That's a very typically Gouldian phrase. And what it means is you've got science over here doing its thing, and you've got religion over here doing this its thing, and they don't in any way meet. And in the world is in the middle. They're like bookends, sort of looking at each other with word in the middle. I think this is nonsense too. It seems to me that religion properly defined is this all-embracing narrative, and the science is embedded within it. But science, as I've been saying, qua science, does not embrace the idea of transcendence, doesn't embrace anything that isn't, as it were, beyond atoms and the void. And if it doesn't do that, then it doesn't really tell us what the universe is really like. I just want to just a few little points about this. I've been listening to a lot of what these sort of paid up atheists have been saying, and one of the things they say, they're very fond of mockery, and one of the objections they make is that you are required, in if you take religion seriously, to believe stuff which is not necessarily, which is can be completely irrational. And Wolpert likes to say that the more irrational the thing is that you believe in, the more brownie points you score. I'm sure you've heard that one. And Jonathan Miller, who's another of these characters, says, you know, we are told that if you want to embrace a religion, you have to make a leap of faith. And I remember him chortling on the television and saying, what is this leap of faith that you need to make? How do you train for this leap? Which was quite witty, but sort of beside the point. I just want to point out that this is actually a foolish way to look at it. And I quite like Karen Armstrong's idea that very few religions actually demand that you should believe particular things. They demand that you should behave in certain ways and do certain things. They don't actually specify, like the Nicene Creed, exactly what it is you are supposed to believe, which is quite an interesting point. And neither do you need to make a great leap. And I'm very impressed in the context of Christianity by people like C.S. Lewis, who actually resisted the idea of Christianity or the idea of religion until he was certainly in his early 20s, and then began to take it, as it were, he began to find it interesting, and then over time he began to take it more and more seriously. And by the time he was about 30, he said, well, yes, I suppose I actually prefer the idea of a worldview that has transcendence in it than one that doesn't, and as it were, ergo, I am religious. And he said he found Christianity, as it were, very comfortable. And a chap who says exactly the same thing and quotes C.S. Lewis in this context is Alistair McGrath. And again, it's this who was a molecular biologist who became an ordained Anglican priest. But the point is, they didn't need to make a leap of faith. They didn't exactly think their way into religion, but they just started taking it seriously. And over time, it sort of crept up on them. And over time, they said, yes, I prefer this way of looking at the universe to my previous way of looking at the universe. And the chap that summarized this whole kind of view of things for me, was not a theologian at all, but Mark Kermode, the art critic, who was writing in The Guardian, and he said, you know, about great works of art, that the meaning of a great work of art is usually obscure, except to people who are already very much in sympathy with that particular genre, whether it's modern painting or whether it's 16th century Italian or whatever. And I thought, yes, it's exactly right. I mean, there are certain things you cannot grasp unless for a long time or for a time you just take them seriously. And the real demand, I think, with religion is not that you make a leap of faith, but that you take it seriously and over time see where it leads you. Another, I'll end this and then I'll move on to the last bit because time's going on. But another point that people like to make against the whole idea of transcendence and the transcendent view of the universe is made, as it were, by people like Lewis Wolpert again, and who likes to say things like, there isn't a shred of evidence for any sort of transcendent force in the universe. And this is, of course, total nonsense. I mean, you know, this is wonderful. Actually, I had here a brilliant quote, now I can't find it, but, oh yes, I can't find it, it's in here. But the point is that the idea that there is, as it were, a purpose in the universe, intelligence behind the universe, is... People who say there is no evidence, to start at the beginning, don't know what evidence is. And an evidence is not cast iron proof that the thing is the case. If it was cast iron proof that a thing is the case, then you wouldn't need courts of law. You wouldn't need anybody to... Evidence is a fact, what you think is a fact, compatible with a certain idea. Are these people saying there is no facts, there are no facts in the universe compatible with the idea that there is, as it were, intelligence behind it or meaning to it or purpose to it? Well, no, of course there are facts. In fact, the facts are so striking that the idea that there is an intelligence is the one that is most obvious, the one that's most intuitive. And the one which says, no, 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 there's nothing, it's just atoms in the void and the laws of physics, that's the one that's counterintuitive. And that, you know, but the point is that if you want to choose between the two on the grounds of evidence, there is a transcendence and there is a non-transcendence. Actually, in terms of evidence, there's nothing to choose between them. Empirically, they are they are neck and neck, I would say. And it's purely a matter of choice in the end which one you decide to go for. And the decision that you might plump for the transcendent view is at least as rational, because it's at least as evidence-based, as the one that you reject it. And that's quite interesting, too, because these people say rationality is obviously the enemy of religion. No, no, the decision to go down that path, or to embrace that way of looking at it, is entirely rational, and as rational as the idea that you should reject it. One last note on transcendence and rationality, and then I'm going to go right into the last bit. In the end, the matter of transcendence is an empirical thing. It's a matter of fact. Either there is a transcendent dimension to the universe, or there isn't. And rationality doesn't have anything to say, in really, about empirical matters. It can tell us how to think straight, or help us to think straight, but it can't tell us what is a fact and what isn't. And it can tell us whether a particular area is worth looking at or whether it isn't. And I think rationality tells us that, as it were, ideas of religion, ideas of transcendence are worth taking seriously. That's it. And in contrast, the decision to write it off a priori, which the sort of militant atheists do, is entirely non-rational. No, it is entirely irrational. It hasn't got any sense to it at all. You cannot write it off a priori. In the last 5 minutes, I want to talk about my favourite chap, almost my favourite chap, who is Charles Darwin, because I was indeed brought up as a biologist. And it seems to me, A, much as I admire the chap, that he got some things wrong, because he was very much a child of his time. But secondly, and more importantly, that the people who have taken his ideas and are most vociferous among the sort of militant atheists, like Dawkins, think of themselves as being modern Darwinists. They are really neo-Darwinists, or as Dawkins would say, ultra-Darwinists. This is a technical point I won't bother to go into, but believe me, they are sort of ultra-neo-Darwinists, if you see what I mean. Darwin's back here somewhere. But the bit that Darwin sort of got wrong, he rooted his ideas, and he says this, he's very explicit about this, in the ideas of Robert Malthus. I say Robert because it's Thomas Robert Malthus, and he was actually known as Robert. Anyway, Robert Malthus, who said, as I think everybody knows, that the human population, or the population of any animals, let's say human population, is bound to grow faster than its food supply will grow. And therefore, the time will come when you collapse. Darwin interpreted this to say, therefore, you are bound to be in competition. And Darwin uses the word competition from the word go. And the subtitle of his book, Origin of Species, 1859, is The Struggle for Life. And later he used the expression struggle for existence. So you have Malthus, who's very much an Enlightenment man, demonstrating, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th, that, as it were, populations are bound to exceed resources. Thrown in the middle, in the 1830-something, you have Tennyson, who coined this wonderful expression, nature red in tooth and claw. 1830s and the beginning of the 19th century was a tremendously difficult time for everybody. Napoleonic wars, terrible weather, harvest failures, etc., etc., etc. Absolutely disastrous time. So he was writing at a time of extreme pessimism. At the same time, you had this collapse, for whatever reason, not quite at then, but a bit later, of Orthodox Christianity, which shattered everybody from Dostoevsky to George Eliot through the whole of the 19th century. This tremendous sort of sudden void opening up. Then you've got Darwin talking about the struggle for existence, natural selection. Then you've got Herbert Spencer redefining natural selection as survival of the fittest, which Darwin then picked up himself and used himself as an expression. So you've got this kind of succession of people from the Enlightenment onwards, of a kind of stream of extreme pessimism, suggesting that life is innately competitive and that, as it were, only the sort of fittest and, by implication, the nastiest come out on top. And then you've got Mendel grafted on, and you've got the molecular biologists, and then you've got game theory, and now you finally, I think finally we might say, 1976, Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene, which the idea there is that it's not the individuals who are competing, but the genes that are competing. And this expression, the selfish gene, which is not strictly speaking what he meant, but it gives the impression that, as it were, not only is everybody locked in conflict because we're bound to be competitive, but that the whole thing, we are terribly selfish as well. Now, there's all sorts of things wrong with the whole thing. I mean, one obvious thing is that actually, if you look at nature, it is far more cooperative overall than it is competitive. If it were not so, it would fall apart. And to be slightly more subtle about this, you can say that, is it really true that that creatures or genes are actually in competition? Is it really true? What you can actually say is that provided a gene, there's an implication that if they are in competition, that they're in permanent conflict. face-to-face conflict. Is that true? Well, all you can really say is not that the genes are constantly trying to push each other aside, but that it is incumbent on a gene or an individual not to go extinct between time T0, as it were, and time TX. As long as you don't go extinct in that time, you're okay. That's the only rule. Is there anything in that which says, in order to avoid going extinct between T0 and TX, you have to have a fight? No, actually, there isn't. It's probably a good idea to come out smiling and be nice to everybody. And so on. You see the point. And you can expand this and say, well, actually, we've got the whole thing wrong. It wasn't never like that. You know, okay, we all have to survive and all that kind of thing, and in the end, natural selection works. But the way that creatures should behave or do behave towards each other really is not related to that at all. There's no great relationship to it. So what I want to say is, and this actually, of course, is exactly what most religions say. You know, compassion, generosity, love, all those things, and they're not, as it were, unnatural. They don't fly in the face of nature, as people like Dawkins would have us believe. I think they are, as it were, entirely natural projections of how life really is. So I am sort of optimistic about the state of the world as it is, and very, very pessimistic about the state of the way the world is understood, and particularly pessimistic about the people who are in charge who have got it totally wrong. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much. Thank you.